Right. I mean, it's up to the people who have handled this, but if people want to just ask questions, feel free to start in, I suppose, really. So, Alex.
Yeah, interested. This is the history I'm interested in. I was brought up in Mount Florida, Glasgow, which is right next door to Hampden Park. But that wasn't our newest club. Our newest club was Third Lanark in Cathkin, which was wound up in 68. And Third Lanark is short for Third Lanark Volunteer Rifles, you see. So I've done a bit of research on this lot, and they were a military volunteer force that was around in Glasgow. Very, very uniformed. They had big trophies. They had shooting competitions. So it seems to me there was a link. I was interested in the link you made between imperialism and the rise of football as a way of controlling people's view on life and their making sure that they were all everyone's disciplined, that sort of thing. So that's how I. What you were saying stimulated this idea in my head.
The military, the thing you've got to remember with the military is there's two sides, particularly in the 19th century. Was there, you know, there's officers and there's the ranks, and there's the upper class and there's the, you know, lump and proletariat that make up the British Army in the 19th century. And the interesting thing with football and the army, I suppose, is that it begins, you know, the British Army, the British Officer Corps, is part of the complex of institutions, public school, elite universities, foreign commonwealth office, imperial civil service. These guys are all, these are the first people playing, you know, association rules football, and, you know, Royal Engineers win the first FA Cup, etc., etc. Football escapes their grasp. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing, is that, you know, by 18...
Blackburn Olympic,
1882?
Yeah.
No, 1881. I can't remember. 1880, anyway, Blackburn Olympic and then Blackburn Rovers. But that's just the sort of, that's the tip of the iceberg, is that, you know, professional northern clubs win the FA Cup, beat the Old Etonians. I mean, football is spread by evangelists, you know, in every grammar school, and then it's through churches, and so it filters down. And so by the time you've got to the kind of 1890s, the kind of upper-class cachet of football that it had in the 1870s, you know, when going to the FA Cup final at Lord's to see Lord Kinnaird, you know, score, was, you know, part of the social scene.
Yeah.
It's definitely not part of the social scene by the 1890s.
You know. They lost. Never won it again, but the Olympic finished them off.
Yeah. I think, you know, yeah, they lost. They had to leave the field, and they went off and played, you know, played cricket and rugby union. So it's interesting, by the time you get to, in terms of imperial spread, the officer corps does spread football, particularly in Africa. So you've got, you know, the first football played in Kenya, in what's now Kenya and Uganda, is through the King's East African Rifles. You know, that's where people are getting their first kind of crack at it in those parts of the world. But in India, you know, the elites of India, partly the reason they don't have never taken to football is by the time football arrives in India, it's very much a game of the ranks. Similarly, in South Africa, the officer corps is playing football, and, you know, it's the ranks. So it has a kind of proletarian baggage, which makes it much less appealing. I mean, I think football and armies, much more sort of ideological connections about kind of control, if you like, the way you put it, is the German embrace of football comes closer to that. So that, you know, in the late 19th century, everyone's going, you know, football, English game, this is not gymnastics, Turnen, this is not German, you know, we can't be playing this. And the German army quite gets into football, and that's a big turning point when it becomes part of the kind of training. And if you look at the early documents from the Deutsche Fußballbund, explaining and promoting football, they cast football in terms, they describe it, football is a war, the pitch is a battle, two armies manoeuvre to get the ball, and the whole kind of tone of the way it sort of souls to the German is in that sort of Teutonic militarist kind of mode. So sometimes sort of, you know, yeah, football is adaptable to that. But I think in terms of, you know, the British Empire never uses it kind of much as an instrument of social control in that way. A little bit in Africa, but for the most part, I think they're sort of slightly, you know, where the army actually is, there's actually not that much football, paradoxically. You know, it's Argentina,
so they've lost
Germany,
they've lost control of it by the time we get to
the
war.
Yeah, and it's lost its kind of cachet. And, you know, I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why the Irish and the Australians take to other forms. But, yeah, you know, football and armies, they're always there. I mean, the Soviets, you know, the whole kind of communist experience, there's plenty of army action. And I note that in Vietnam, the gambling industry on football is run by the army, which is a kind of interesting diversification for the Vietnamese armed forces.
Thank you.
Will.
Yes, I wonder what your thoughts were on Game 39 and whether this whole thing's going to be, you know, is it actually going to go ahead at some point or if it's been killed or what?
I think it's wrong.
Yeah.
I think it's wrong. I mean, you know, I don't have a problem. I mean, you know, people want to watch the Premiership all over the world, fine. You know, I think that's, and you know, what are you going to do anyway? That's sort of unstoppable. The cat is out of the bag. But I mean, I think, you know, the whole 39th game thing is just, it's just taking the mickey. And to what end? You know, that's what I say, to what end? Everyone's making a lovely living. You know, what everyone needs to earn more money out of Manchester United than they are. I cannot see the point of it. I absolutely just cannot see the point of it from this end. I mean, I can understand why people who've discovered Manchester United in the last 3 years in Singapore would like the opportunity to see Manchester United play. Fair enough. And I'm sure there's a lot of Thais now who are discovering. I mean, the thought of Thai culture and Manchester City's kind of history is, I don't even know where to begin on that connection. But, I mean, fine, you want to watch Man City, fine. But, I mean, and they want to go there in the kind of off-season and play. I don't have a problem with that either. But I think to kind of distort the competitive structure of British football or of English football by doing that, it's just, I just think it's not on. Stop it. Great.
I was wondering if you had any ideas on why football seems to attract amongst the kind of minority of the fans a sort of cult of violence in the kind of hooliganism which you don't really see in other sports.
You do see it in other sports. I mean, there's a bit of a myth going on there. You don't see it as much. And football's sort of widespread nature means there's more of it. But you've certainly over the years had, you know, definitely had lots of fighting in baseball in the States of various kinds. I mean, why does it attract? I mean, large numbers of overexcitable young men placed in kind of, you know, theatrically conflictual situations does offer itself up. And I think that's a sort of, just a sort of truism of it. I think the popular theatre dimension, the idea that football is just this extraordinary place for the creation and reinforcement and reinvention of identities. I mean, it offers that in a way. I mean, no individual sport would ever offer that. You know, because like once Tiger Woods dies, that's that. You know, there is no Tiger Woods, but Arsenal lives on. So individual games don't lend themselves to this kind of creating of sort of solidarities and identities. Football does, and it does it. And, you know, football exists in societies that are profoundly divided. I mean, when I went to Israel, and I was sort of, you know, asking people about, you know, how they felt, you know, what football was about for them. I mean, so many people would say, in effect, you can go to the stadium and say what you can't say elsewhere, you know, or you can go to the stadium and you can feel a togetherness, which, given, you know, any kind of togetherness in Israel also means being against somebody else, because that is the setup of the place. And football offers people, you know, who are marginal to political and cultural processes, the opportunity to kind of dramatise that, which is why, you know, when I went to see Beitar Jerusalem, you know, you've got the main chant of the night was Kali Ramat Kal. And Ramat Kal is shorthand for the chief of staff of the Israeli Defence Force. And Kali is a Croat, he's their goalkeeper. And he went on telly the night before this game and said, in English, he said, "I can't understand why you allowed the shelling with missiles of Sidrot and Ashkelon, which are near the Gaza Strip," and they get missiles out of the Gaza Strip being fired at them periodically. He said, "In Croatia, when we had these problems, we knew how to deal with them. Shoot, kill, destroy. I think it's time for Israel to go like this." And this is on national television. I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine? It's like, how can I put it?
Jens Lehmann.
It's sort of like, it's sort of, yeah, Jens Lehmann coming on telly during, you know, during the troubles in Ireland and saying, I can't understand how the English state allows the bombing of mainland England. You know, why don't you invade the Republic of Ireland? I mean, it's like, and the response of the crowd is the scene, you know, Kelly, the chief of staff, and they really, and Kelly, minister of security. So football offers an opportunity to say something, and that's what those guys think. Right or wrong, that's where they're coming from. That's the world that these, that those, that that, that particular group of fans lives in. And football offers them that opportunity in a way that, that just nothing else does. I don't think that's a full explanation, but it's part of it.
On the subject of Israel, we have Europe up here, and then Israel's somewhere down here. How did Israel get into the is it the European Cup?
Okay. When things kicked off, Israel was allocated to the Asian Football Confederation. I mean, football geography is a bit odd anyway. Egypt, is Egypt in Africa? Is it in the Middle East? Is it in Asia? Anyway, Israel goes into the Asian Football Confederation. Everything is fine till about 1964, when people increasingly start going, we're not going to play with you. So they go to the Asian Games in Indonesia, and Suharto says, you guys can't play. And then there's a riot at a game that they play against Iran in the Asian Cup in 74. And basically everybody from the North Koreans down says, we're not playing anymore with you. And so the solution initially is that they play their World Cup qualifying games in Oceania. So there's some pretty interesting football results, playoffs for the World Cup finals, where it's kind of Israel versus the Solomon Islands or New Zealand. This continues until the late 80s, and then in the early 90s they become part of UEFA. They become part of UEFA, you know, partly because it was a sort of practical political solution geographically, but, you know, Israel is, in many ways, is a European colonial project, so it sort of makes sense in a way for Israel to be part of UEFA. So that's how it's happened. You know, so Palestine, you know, which was accepted for FIFA membership in 98, you know, plays in the Asian Football Confederation. But that's probably, you know, I don't think it's a good idea just at the moment for World Cup qualifiers, Israel-Palestine. There was one for the World Cup qualifiers for 19... Which one was it? For 38, for France 38, and there was a game between, I think it was a sort of, you know, Palestine mandate team, but they were all Jewish because the Palestinian mandate FA was basically a Zionist creation, and they went about making sure everybody else wasn't playing in it. And I think they played Egypt, or I can't quite remember. So they have, you know, but no, it wouldn't be a good, it's good that they're separate. I think this makes sense.
Should we be trying to keep them out? Should we be, because we're just like we used to keep South Africa and their apartheid out of sport to an effect of heightening awareness of what's going on and saying what you're doing is out of order. Should we be doing the same with Israel and their apartheid?
Didn't we to say that?
Well, the thing, you know, I mean, the South African case is an interesting one because it is a case where a boycott really did have an impact. I mean, most boycotts are a complete waste of time. I really think. I think like boycotting the Beijing Olympics is pointless. The South African one is interesting because you had a small ruling class who were peculiarly sensitive to their standing in the international sporting sphere, which made it a really good thing to have a boycott because it was like hitting them where it hurts. Whereas I'm not sure, you know, I mean, like all the most extreme people in Israel don't like sport. You know, the ultra-Orthodox and the religious right. Certainly don't do sport. And the settlers, you know, they're not, that's not their game. I mean, Beitar are obviously far to the right. So I'm not sure you'd be hitting people where it hurt by doing that. I mean, I do think that, you know, as and when Beitar Jerusalem play in the Champions League, that UEFA should, you know, give them the absolute once-over in terms of racist chanting. you know, because I can't believe that any Beitar crowd can manage to control themselves for more than 2 seconds. So they'll get themselves banned if there's a serious disciplinary action, and I think there should be. I think that goes for all clubs, but, you know, Beitar are sort of cruising for a bruising on this front. So I'm generally against boycotts. I mean, I think, you know, it's like taking your bat and ball home, and in the sphere of play, I think you've got to play with the bad guys. Is my feeling. I mean, I'm not absolute about that. I don't think it's sort of completely black and white. But, you know, and I think, you know, when Beitar play in the Champions League, and I suspect they might do, there's a good chance they'll make it to the group stage, because they are basically the Israeli national team plus, so they're quite good. You know, that's an opportunity to you know, make sure an alternative message is heard. You know, I hope that happens, you know, and there are ways of making that happen, but I'm not sure that a boycott is the answer, because, you know, it's like, all right, you boycott Israel, it's like, where are you going to stop? I mean, there's, you know, there's plenty of other unpleasant regimes in the world, so, and there's so much division anyway, and it's like, you know, the whole kind of global commons thing, I think, is lost. So sometimes you have got to get into bed with horrible people, basically. But I think, you know, it's a political judgment. There's an argument both ways.
Steve?
Surely the idea of football is beyond the political barriers, isn't
it?
The idea that anyone, you know, what we're saying is you take a football somewhere, we've had cases of this going to Mexico now, and it stops at army checkpoints, you start kicking the ball up, and they're all, sorry, they're only a football team.
Yeah.
That just the football will break down barriers in that respect.
Yeah. Which is why I think.
So we ought to be encouraging the playing of sport between countries that don't get on, because it's a way of breaking down, like the Christmas Day game in the First World War.
Yeah.
There's a lot of myth about that, I think, but the idea that soldiers rather play football and shoot each other for one day.
Yeah, I think that, as I say, I think it's good. You've got to play with the bad guys, you've got to play with people you don't like. It's a really good lesson, you know, generally in life, in politics, to learn. So that's why I'm generally against boycotts. But I don't think that means the fact that that football has a kind of universal quality to it, and offers the possibility of unity over division, does not mean that it's not a political thing.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, you use it as a political. It's proactive, isn't it? Saying we can play football regardless of who political beliefs.
Yeah,
we can go beyond, you know.
I think this is a good thing.
By saying we both enjoy playing football.
No, I think it's a really good thing, and I think it's particularly good when it comes from below rather than above, because when states make those kinds of gestures, we're all rightly a bit cynical, because we all think you're just doing this because it looks good. So where it comes from below, you know, with kind of, you know, socially organised initiatives, I think it's sort of a particularly powerful and good thing.
Kev?
Do you think you're possibly a bit kind to English football support? I mean, I know I haven't seen the book yet, and you may talk for a while, but Will's question about Game 39 or whatever, I mean, I've become more and more critical over the last few years about professional football, and I feel like people get what they deserve. Like, football fans, you know, invite this kind of, they don't care who's putting the money in, they want to be the richest club, they want to get the Premier League, you know, they don't mind that the soul's being sold out of the club, because they just want to win, they just want to have this, they want to have this. I mean, for example, Manchester City, the guy's come in, he's not a nice guy, but people go, well, he's going to put money into the club. And then he sacks the manager and they don't like it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're getting, it's only going one way. These people that have a lot of money from bad places, they're not your friend, you know, and they're not doing things in your interest. And then to turn around and bleat about it, say, oh, they're going to take the game out of the country, it's kind of...
Yeah, I agree with you. You know,
there needs to be a morality amongst football supporters earlier on, really.
You suck with the devil, you know, you better have a long spoon, and we haven't got a very long spoon, and people get themselves into all sorts of practical and ethical dilemmas. You know, I've got friends who, you know, are kind of begging, literally, you know, for the Dubai crew to come and buy Liverpool. You think, what? An alliance between the working class of Liverpool and a micro kingdom and potentate, and this is not right. Something's wrong here. So I think, yes, I mean, I think you know, people have made some bad and short-sighted decisions. I mean, good political lesson to learn, if only there was kind of mechanisms to actually enforce the learning in a way. And yeah, to an extent we do get the football that we sort of deserve. You know, I think there is a lot of truth in that, and there isn't much organisation, and there isn't much appetite amongst some, you know, some parts of the crowd and some parts of the sort of wider football culture. But I think, you know, I mean, that's our society, isn't it? I mean, that's not peculiar to football. That is, that tells us something about England, I think. You know, and you just got to be optimistic. You know, there's an English radical tradition as well that can be drawn upon in this. So, you know, we also have Supporters Direct. We have When Saturday Comes. You know, we have quite a thriving amateur football scene. We have a lot of interesting development projects, you know, both in this country and outside. There are good things happening, you know, and it's not all a complete disaster yet. But yeah, no, the Premiership is ugh. You know, I mean, I'm torn because when it's good, it's fantastically, I do think it is really great to watch. And I think the Champions League in particular is actually, for my money, I don't think football's ever been played so well on a regular basis anywhere ever in the world.
The same people win every year, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, well, you know, it's a group of kind of, well, let's think, I mean, in the last 10 years, there's, what, been 8 different teams have won it? Actually, Milan have won it twice, Real have won it a couple of times, Porto have won it, Man United have won it, we're going back to 99. Bayern have won it. I mean, yeah, it's a small number of rich clubs. I agree.
The
Premiership is more boring. The Premiership is definitely more boring. The Champions League, because you've got, you know, this cluster of about 10 really big clubs, you know, it is more competitive. And that's what I think is the best. I think the Premiership is not, for my money, is not, I mean, I watch it because, you know, I'll watch it for whatever, but the Champions League actually, I think, is a cut above. And having watched the equivalent in South America, the Copa Libertadores, it's just like different. It really is different, you know, in terms of quality. That's the problem, though. You know, it's the best there is, but you know, it comes with strings attached.
Yeah, I've just put my own hand up actually. I've kind of spotted you, but yeah, just quickly, I just wanted to say something about this idea about real experience, because I just give a, you know, obviously Eastern Cowboys and all that, just give an idea, called a comment that was made, it called caused a big dispute in our club a few years ago. One of our teams managed to win a cup, and a person who should remain nameless said, yeah, I was, who played for us as well, and he said, I was driving down by the Plough, which is our pub. And he said, I saw, I'll name this person, Eddie Bridges, out, some of you might know. He said, I saw Eddie Bridges outside the pub, right, with a cup, right, dancing about in the road, right, for this cup. And he said, oh, you know, I looked at it, I thought, you know, what a load of bollocks. He said, like, you know, I mean, it's like the, whatever it was, the Sunday second division or something, or third division or something. And he said, and he had this bit of silver, he was dancing around, he was so happy, he said, and I just thought, it's not real football. You know, real football is watching the Gas, like, you know, watching Rovers. And he said, like, you know, so I think it's a load of bollocks, right? And everybody sat in the room that night, heard him say that, said, like, he hasn't grasped about what our club's about at all. And we talked about it quite a lot. And that night, I mean, one of the things that came out was, like, one of the reasons I think that football's so important on an amateur level or in the park or wherever, in fact, not even organised leagues, is I actually think personally that when I play football that I have a human experience which is as valuable as any fucking professional footballer, right? My personal human experience of playing football is as valuable as anybody in the Premier League who plays fucking David Beckham or whatever it is, right? Like when I score, you know, when we take part in football as this theatre and we play, and you know, I was saying to this guy, you know, don't you understand that Eddie Bridges has been running around in the fucking rain on Tuesday nights for a whole, you know, 8 months training and playing in games, getting kicked, you know, getting himself fit despite, you know, his potential drug and alcohol problems. You know, and like, that's hard, you know, that's hard. These pros, like, you know, they're looked after, you know, we don't get paid, you know, and I never want to get paid to play football, and, you know, and we have difficulties, we have jobs and kids and we have our own experience of drug and alcohol problems, and we play and we get wet and we get hurt and we win, and when we win and we will win a cup, it's a major human experience, right? And I
what I worry about with the Premier League and why I went on about at the start is that I believe that they are trying to usurp that human experience. They're trying to say that being a spectator of their football is a better experience than actually playing it and actually being involved in it. And that really worries me, because to me that is an attempt by people who own football, the people who market football, to try and convince people not to play because there's no money in that game for them. Mm. And they want you to buy it. And I wonder if you want to comment on that.
I think the moment, in a way, even more insidious and something even higher up their agenda is to say, to be a fan in our league actually is to be a consumer, mm-hmm. is to be a customer. I mean, you know, they pay their, you know, minor dues to amateur football, but I think the place they really want to get to is the whole, you know, actually we'd like you to be well-behaved consumers, and we're into the whole kind of prawn sandwich sort of territory, and I think that is, you know, that's really insidious. I think the gentleman who was horrible about Eddie Bridges is rather mean-spirited. Is what I think about him. What a lovely image! The thought of Eddie will stay with me with his gun dancing. How nice! I mean, you know, let's face it. Middle-aged English men don't dance in public very much. Shame on us. You know,
won't be so generous when he's talked to you through every goal.
The conversation, but you know, yeah, and I think, I mean, that's not just the Premiership, you know, that's a whole sort of thing in our society, is that it's better to consume than participate, is the message that's coming from a million different places, you know. I mean, it's, you know, celebrity culture in general, you know, better to be a voyeur than live your life. I mean, it's such a kind of insidious and awful message, and football's sort of one little bit of that. I mean, which is why, you know, the amateur game and all of that is just so profoundly important. I mean, you know, football, all football cultures, you know, I suppose, are parasitic. The professional football cultures are all parasitic on amateur football cultures, you know, both playing and participation. Because without that, what is there? If there wasn't that, there wouldn't be any professional football, you know. Or professional football in a complete sort of separate vacuum from all of that.
Yeah.
What's that? I mean, that's not a place I want to...
American sport.
Say again?
That's American sport.
Yeah.
You go to America, you've got basketball, people might play it apart, but it's not organised leagues. Yeah. American football, people don't play once they reach adult world.
Yeah.
There's no organised sport for them.
Yeah.
So they watch it.
Yeah. No, that's very
true.
They're
consumers, and that's what, over here, you know, you can watch football all your life, but you can still play Saturday afternoons as an adult.
Basketball retains some of that because it's a much more, you know, pick-up game. It's an urban game.
Yeah,
football.
They play pick-up games, but not organised leagues don't happen as much.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
When we played cricket against the Taunton Homies, a lot of them have played baseball up to a certain level. And then they sort of dropped out of baseball, and I said, why do you drop out of baseball? And they said, well, we got as high as our ability had let us get, and then there was nothing.
Yeah.
And I think that's tragic, because, I mean, in this country you can play football at a lot of different levels, and you can play cricket at a lot of different levels.
And I think
that's the important thing, that everyone can play.
Yeah, no, it's a disaster. To destroy all of that is a complete disaster.
Just one more thing about that before I let Dave speak, who's next. Basically, you just got to think to yourself, you know, where do you want to die? Do you want to die in front of watching the telly, you know, watching football telly? Do you want to die on a football pitch? And I know where I want to die. So, Dave.
Yeah, I just think, you know, like what you've said today, is, you know, there's loads of positives about football. I mean, one of the matches that springs to mind was I was playing in Morocco, and there was like probably about 15, maybe 20 people on each side. Do you know what I mean? Anyone can join in at any time.
Yeah.
And there's also people like twins, for example, one of the brothers got a left boot and the other one's got the right boot, you know, and they're actually sharing boots in that way. Some people are barefooted and stuff like that. So, you know, loads of positives as well. But the interesting point for me was what the guy said at the front about the fans and some of the trouble that he's see sort of like in the fan base and stuff like that. And well, I've only gone to a few rugby matches, for example, but you know, as a football fan, not a rugby fan, I think is a massive difference in watching rugby compared to watching football. That strikes me in that football is all about divisions. So it's pretty much like the fan base are not very mixed up, for example. Go and watch a rugby match. I don't know if it was just a particular match I was watching, it was Scotland versus Ireland, but everyone's like bantering with each other and everyone's much more kind of like open about which team they support. But go and watch sort of, you know, England, Scotland, or even maybe Ireland, Scotland, you know, you wouldn't get that mixed fan experience. And people, if you buy cheap tickets to go and see sort of Arsenal away from home in Derby, you don't want to go in there with your Arsenal shirt, for example.
Mm.
And I just find that's quite interesting and almost a bit of a shame, like, about the game.
It's kind of an English thing, though. I mean, what interested me about football, I mean, I come, you know, to football from a slightly odd angle, I guess. Like, you know, Paul, I was more interested in juggling when, you know, when I was younger. And, you know, it struck me that football was like juggling, except in juggling you have lots of props and one person, and in football you've got one prop and lots of people. Long story short, a lot of people, some people took me out to France to the World Cup. We went to this Brazil-Morocco game in Nantes. Brazil hammered Morocco. And after the game, there was a bit of tension, you know, between the crowds. And the Moroccans were on the one side going, Morocco, Morocco, Morocco. The Brazilians on the other side stood, Brazil, Brazil, Brazil. And there was a bit of tension. But they had musicians with them. And the Moroccans had these crazy flautists doing their stuff. And Brazilians had some samba players. And at a certain point, the tension rose, and the musicians kind of looked at one another and went, ah, fuck it. Started playing together, and everybody just started dancing samba together. And the chant actually went, Brazil, Morocco, Brazil. And it just was like, sort of what happened on the pitch. You know, we're here in some strange French city, and what are we going to do? Are we going to have a fight over this, or are we going to have a good time? It was a total revelation to me, because that was my overwhelming opinion of football until that moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I didn't understand it until I saw football outside this country.
And I think it's got worse over the years with the separation and the amount of effort that goes into it. And like, if you do go and see an away match and you sit in away fans, you won't banter. You know, it'll take a while, but you might.
I've spent at Anfield for many years, especially as a student outside Liverpool, the only way you could get into Liverpool games was in the away end.
Mm.
And the test was, if you could say Mary has a little lamb without a Scouse accent, they'll let you in. And so at most games at Anfield, about a third of the away end was Scouse students who had left home and could avoid the accent. And there was no problem at all. I've never encountered problems in away ends at football matches.
Mm.
I've watched Liverpool beat Man U 3-0 at the Stretford, while sitting in the Stretford end many, many years ago, because we've not beaten 3-0 in decades. But I just think it's exaggerated and taken out of all proportion. I just don't see that balance from opposing fans at all,
yeah,
when I've been at games.
I've been to think over us quite a few times in the way end. Never had any problem. Have lots of chat. Yeah. So can I just have...
The guy in the orange.
I was just going to say, notice you put your woman's top on, but just a bit you touched on earlier about the sort of fan ownership and stuff like that, and I don't know, it comes up this guy thinks he's going to get all these people to pay £5,000 to be a member of Liverpool or whatever, and just where you think compared to like the Spanish model where it can go in Britain, if that's ever going to happen, that there'll be a top flight team that's solely owned by the fans, and how that would work itself out, if ever.
I mean, the cat is slightly out of the bag, of course, you know, because once these things are sold, they become very, you know, it's the problem of renationalisation. It's politically tricky and economically terribly expensive, short of, you know, forcible takeovers, yeah. And as I'm not sure we're looking at that in the near in the near future at any rate. I think it's going to be very hard to... without a change in legislation. I mean, if you really want to see a change in the ownership of football clubs, you know, you've got to introduce laws along the lines of the Germans or the French, which says, you know, you can have private investment, but the ultimate owner of a football club must be what in effect will be a voluntary sector organisation that holds it in trust. You know, you can be commercial, you can have a commercial operation, but actually, that's the way the ownership system has. Now, whether it is possible to reintroduce that,
into this country. You know, I'm not a commercial lawyer or a business person, but I think it would be pretty hard to do so. So I think for the moment the best bet is about, though I do think you should have much, much stricter legislation about who's allowed to own a football club. You know, and you could conceivably introduce legislation about how much of a football club you could own as well. Those are sort of more minor things. Are we going to see someone make it into the Premiership, sort of Ebbsfleet United styling? It's not inconceivable. You know, it's unlikely, but it's not inconceivable.
Yeah.
Yes, just to ask a bit about, we talked about amateur football, but in particular about youth football, because I was quite involved in the youth team for about 5 to 6 years, and the amount of resources that go into youth football in terms of money is zero. Yeah. I had to take kids in the back of my van to get, you know, get to matches, which is completely illegal. Sometimes I have, you know, 6 or 7 kids in the back of my van. And I guess the question is really, is there any way of getting money into it without it becoming corrupt? Because the teams actually do run, and they run democratically. You have elections, people are elected as managers, chairs, secretaries of clubs. It's a very sort of democratic structure.
Yeah.
And there's just hundreds and hundreds of these teams.
Yeah.
The referees get paid crap. I mean, they get barricaded from both sides of parents and all that. But there's just no money available.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I was really, you know, risking it for 5 or 6 years, taking these kids from Hawford in Lockley in the back of my van every day.
Yeah.
But if I didn't do it, the matches wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but, you know, there's just no money for minibuses or anything. But what worries me, if you start putting money into these clubs, then you get corruption and how you control it, or whether you professionalise it in some way, have professional coaches.
Yeah.
You know, because the kids won't, you know, the level of training was crap as well, because it's just parents training them, and they're not professional coaches.
Yeah.
Which is, in my view, is part of the problem why we're not actually getting good players in this country at the moment. But I don't know whether there's any other model which would you have views how it could
work. Oh, there are definitely other models. I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, youth training in Argentina or in the Netherlands, you know, I mean, both as a form of massively extended complex feeder system for professional clubs, as well as a kind of general social service, just incomparable levels of organisation and money. I mean, you know, we're sort of in the usual problem in this country of, you know, the backlog of neglect is so gigantic, both in terms of, you know, hard infrastructure, minibuses, you know, pitches with changing rooms, you know, which is just a sort of laughable thing, as well as kind of the soft stuff, you know, organisation, coaches and so on. We're a long, long way behind. You know, we've let it go to pot for kind of 35, 40 years. I mean, not that there, you know, before that you just had a lot more poor, hungry, working class boys, which of course makes for a fantastic youth system generally. I mean, that is the truth, is that, you know, widespread poverty and lack of economic alternatives is fantastically good news for football cultures. The FA has just spent £100 million, which is, you know, I'm happy to be the FA's biggest critic, but they have finally got it together to punt up some proper money.
Where's that money going?
Well, there's the question. Well, I mean, they've announced they're spending £100 million. Quite how they're spending it, last edition of When Saturday Comes is worth a look on that. I think, you know, there's going to be a programme of sorting out pitches, and there's going to be a coaching programme, but the fine detail, like, is it going to come to somebody like you in your situation, or is it going to be bureaucratised? I don't know, and I'm not sure. I suspect there's a lot to be learned from looking around the world, though. There's a lot of places where people have really got it together, you know. I mean, partly, you know, and I hope they also spend it not just on, you know, outdoor, but also on futsal and indoor football and a kind of range of stuff, rather than, you know, clean the dog poo off the pitch and build a new shower, which is fine, and that's good. You know, I'm not against that, but I think you've got to kind of take it much further. So there is a real need for it, and in this country, given the declining number of young people, how much activity they're doing, etc., etc., you know, it should be a major public policy priority. And it's sort of crazy, you know, the Labour government over the last 10 years has used football for a whole variety of sort of social projects, be they kind of the study centres of professional football clubs, or playing for success, various kind of educational programs, social service work, all of which is great. I'm completely, you know, more of it, terrific. But at the same time, the actual money for playing the game has not been there, which I think is a real, they just sort of don't get it a bit.
Right, the Palestinian Gouda at the back.
Thank you. I wanted to share two concurrent stories of pessimism and optimism. Being an Arsenal season ticket holder, obviously pessimistic at the moment, but I was thinking about what I would have felt like if we had carried on and won the league. And actually, it wouldn't have meant as much to me as it did in 1989, when we won the league with like 10 English players, 5 or 6 of them came through the Arsenal youth team. So I do find it kind of, yeah, it's not the personal experience that it used to be. And I'm sharing the new ground with 20,000 people who have hardly ever been to a football match in their life, who aren't the generational Arsenal fans that you've been talking about, who go to the games all the time, who've been going for generations. So that's a bit of a pessimistic thing, and I don't know how that's going to get better in this current situation. Then on the optimistic side, I went to Palestine with the Cowboys last year, and prior to that I hadn't actually played football myself for 20 years, but I started playing again last year. And I think you mentioned something, you said something about what was the best thing you've seen recently on a football pitch or whatever. And the best thing that I've seen recently is last Monday at St Paul's Sports Centre on the tarmac, I run through on the left, cut inside, sack. Best goal I've scored for 25 years.
You've got to chat very late, don't you? Anybody who hasn't spoken yet who wants to speak? Right, then Kev.
It was a while back, but I think it's kind of over. It was that contribution about the World Cup, which I thought was quite interesting, because for me, the World Cup, I like the World Cup, and I've been down to little bits of 2 World Cups. And sometimes it can be really great, because you do get these sets of fans mixing together, do meet people from other countries. But it's also quite false, I think, in a couple of ways. Mainly because the people that go and watch the national team at the World Cup aren't a great cross section of the people that live in that country. So you're not going to see lots of everyday Africans making the trip over to Europe and paying, you know, 50, 60 quid for a ticket. You only have to see like the African Nations tournament a couple of months ago, which is always really good. The empty stadiums, you know, there was some of the games where there's no one there, which is a travesty really. And there's a lot of kind of economics involved in who's going to watch those games and what class those people are from, and, you know, and also the other point of it was that if you've been to Brazil to watch a Brazilian first division professional game or second division, you could probably go to a lot of games where there'd be violence, you know, 10 times worse than any violence you'd see in England anymore. So it's not always, I don't think the World Cup's necessarily the best barometer of kind of football culture, because I think it's actually not just because the way it's stage managed or whatever, but just because of the people that take part in it don't really reflect what's going on in a country itself and the mass of people that are involved. But I don't know if that's
what I agree with you. I suppose that experience took place at one of the public screens outside the grounds rather than in the ground itself, so it wasn't really, you know, there are a lot of Moroccan folk living in France, so I don't know if those people were rich Moroccans or poor Moroccans or whatever. They were just congregated in that main square. I agree with you that people that can fly to Europe from Brazil are going to be limited. But you know, for me, it's just that sort of experience of people coming to football from a different place. I think you mentioned that to start with, didn't you? It was that people have appropriated the game such that it's not sort of, they're not being told to do this, you know. So the culture that they bring to it was actually very inclusive, and it was inclusive from the musical point of view. It's the musicians that provoked that breaking the tension. Not the fans, but the musicians that they had with them. And I thought that was an interesting music, I would say, is something. Okay, the styles of music could be different, but you know, you could say that different countries play different styles of football.
Mm.
And I think music is perhaps the common language in the same way that, that football seems to be.
I'm just having trouble with Chinese classical music.
I was just going to say, I think it's so depressing to see international tournaments with empty stadiums.
Yeah.
I cannot, I absolutely hate that. And, you know, I think it should be a precondition of FIFA and UEFA's kind of, when they let someone host, it's like, you cannot have empty stadiums, you know. And if you've got to give the tickets away, for God's sake, just give the tickets away. You know, or set the prices so that, you know, they will be full. It is absolutely absurd, you know, in a place like Ghana, you know, where football is pretty bloody popular, for there to be empty stadiums. But it was the same, I mean, in I went to the African Nations Cup in Tunisia, I mean, it was kind of heartbreaking to watch kind of Congo play in front of, I don't know, about 25 Congolese who made the trip from Belgium, you know, to come and see them. I mean, occasionally there are moments when it doesn't. And God, when it happens the other way, it's amazing. I went to see Algeria versus Egypt in Tunisia, and 30,000 Algerians seem to have crossed the Sahara Desert to come to see. So there was this cavalcade of kind of, you know, old pickup trucks and camper vans, and they really had crossed the Sahara to come to Tunisia, and that was absolutely one of the most electric occasions I've ever been at. I mean, I think on the World Cup as well, it's not just about who's there, it's the fact that, you know, I found Germany 2006, I only went to one game, but I found the kind of corporate signage and the extent to which it was, you know, the event was being arranged for the 30% of ticket holders of the FIFA family. It was just a bit grotesque, really. I also think, you know, if you're going to throw a month-long party, you know, treat it as a party. Don't just treat it as a kind of exercise in kind of conference logistics, which is increasingly what happens on these occasions. You know, I think, you know, I mean, if we're going to try and host the World Cup in 2018, you know, I think the whole country, you've got to be looking to make the whole country something along the lines of a carnival. Right, with, you know, one half of the country in shirts and one without. I mean, it's got to be a mass participation thing. There's got to be room for more than just the kind of conventional corporate stuff. And, you know, the opportunity actually to throw the most extraordinary cultural and sporting party, it, you know, is available if one had the wit and the imagination, you know, imagination to do it. I mean, I think it should be a precondition that every World Cup, you've got 32 countries. So for God's sake, organise a music festival and invite the musicians from those 32 countries, you know. Because what else are we doing when the football's not on?
Well, I'm just going to butt in there, like, before I get the next one. But, you know, I mean, come to our international football tours. We organise across Europe with our network. You know, all the things you've just said are absolutely vital. I mean, some people have said that football, our tournaments, is like wallpaper. You know, it's like it's there and it's good. You watch it during the day, but it's about partying, you know, it's about all the other aspects of it. And I would argue that, you know, because we are football fans and players, we actually understand what a tournament's about. And actually these people who organise these tournaments don't, because actually they don't often experience the real nature of being a fan or a player. So they, to them, and obviously they're tied into this sort of, you know, business arrangement, so they don't understand that. And it is the same culture that appeared in English football grounds for a long time, which is that, you know, these are the punters, they come in, you know, we cage them in, you know, we get their money and send them off again, you know, and that don't actually want anything to do with them, really. And I would argue World Cups are like that. I mean, there have been attempts by the fans' organisations and supporters to try and get over that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what is it about? It's not just about football. Our tournaments, when we put them on, which we've been doing for 15 years, you know, they're not just about football. They're clearly not about football. I mean, how the hell are you going to get all the kids and everybody else who doesn't like football to come, which you want there? I mean, personally speaking, you know, my personal sexual politics, I don't actually want to spend the fucking, you know, a weekend with 500 blokes, you know. I don't, actually. I want to spend it with, you know, everybody, you know. And, you know, obviously, you know, whatever. It's, I think when we said our first tournament, we said, you know, our tournaments are about the community, they're about, you know, everybody being there, about football, they're about drama, they're about drinking, they're about partying, they're about bands, they're about music, and they're about sex as well. And those things have to be there to make it a party.
And if you don't have those things, if you have these divisions and, you know, anyway, shut up.
No, I think fair enough. I just draw the line at legalising brothels a lot.
Let's cut the exchange relation out of it, is all I say, but I'm rich.
Yeah, I've been trying to formulate this question in my head. It might come out as a series of random statements. But you sort of touched on football changing, or the setup of football changing is it's threatened by alternatives. And I think cricket has had two major alternatives that have changed the game irrevocably. But they were both provided by big money. The first one was the Packer League in Australia. And I'd say the second one's just started now, which is the India Premiership. But they're both major money outings. In this country, according to the verified BBC documentary that was made on women's football in this country, after the First World War, women's football provided an alternative to the professional men's game, where they were raising money for injured soldiers and stuff after the First World War. And the FA ended up taking against that in rather a bad way, because it was drawing very large crowds, which they feared were detracting from the professional men's game. And they didn't, in fact, end up sanctioning women's football again till 1976 or something like that. And the Cowboys, their Saturday B team play in the FA, something like 23 rungs down below the Premiership. But they're still in the FA. So sort of my thoughts are, can sort of the higher echelons of the capitalist and professional game that's so much in the clinches of money men and corrupt members of institutions such as the FA and FIFA and UEFA. I mean, how do we change this? Will an alternative system of administration in the game ever stand a chance of threatening them? Or are we looking at a revolution from below, from teams like AFC Wimbledon and FC United. I mean, are enough teams like that going to spring up that the nature of the beast of the Football Association could be challenged from within the system? Or are we looking at a challenge from without the system, where an alternative to the FA may spring up? Because the Eastern Cowboys are a fairly left field team, but even their teams all play within FA leagues.
Lots of things there. I don't think it's an either or. I mean, I think given that the forces of Mordor are so overwhelming, one should sort of take all possible opportunities rather than restrict oneself just to one way of challenging them. I think the FA are guilty of incompetence and entrenched sexism and racism, and they have a culture of deep and profound amateurism in their administration and organisation, and a bureaucracy that is ludicrous to say the least, and it's full of self-serving people, and it's become detached from its kind of ethical and sort of, you know, social demands that are placed upon it. But I don't think the FA is really the enemy. I mean, the FA has been buffeted and battered by the forces of capitalism without the wit or the means to really do very much about it. So I'm not sure, while there's all sorts of things one can have a go at the FA at, I think the kind of, you know, the overweening power of money is not... I mean, you know, they played their part in sanctioning the Premier League breakaway in 92. you know, which is their sort of original sin in this. But they have, you know, in a funny way, you know, if you look back historically, I mean, the FA, for what could never be called socialist reasons, has actually sought to limit power of money. I mean, for example, the FA restricted the amount that you could earn withdrawer's dividends from a football club, because although football clubs, you know, they were share owners, but the shares were always, like, you know, worthless. Nobody really wanted them until you worked out that you could buy the whole club and make a lot of money and float it. But before that, the FA basically didn't want people to make money out of football. They dissuaded them by limiting the amount of money you could take out as dividends, for example. So they're, I would describe them as sort of rather conservative with small c, sort of old-fashioned, rather than sort of raging neoliberals. So I'm not sure that they're the problem alone. I mean, in terms of sort of challenging it, I just think it's got to come at all levels, and we don't know yet what the kind of the future football culture looks like and how it will be made. I think you have to look, given how big and powerful some of these institutions are and how out of order it's become, there is a need for national and global level regulation and legislation. I mean, something we haven't talked about, but I do think it's really important to think about, is salary caps. You know, people go, all salary caps never work, salary caps never work as a way of equalising. And I just sort of think, yes, they do. Look at the NFL. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. It's got the strictest salary cap system in the world. And what happens? You know, different people win it all the time and it's competitive. I mean, even baseball, you know, is actually quite competitive in America, relative compared to the Premiership, say. And they have quite a serious salary cap. So I think there's, you know, we can debate salary caps, the rights and wrongs all night, but at that level, that's something that's got to come from above, you know. I think I rather like the FA in a funny way, because I like the pyramid. I like the fact that Eastern Cowboys are in the same institution as Manchester United, that there is a sort of organic connection that spans the nation. That's part of one of the great pleasures of English football. For me, is that there are 92 clubs, and there are clubs, you know, it pains me that there isn't one in Cornwall. But there will be, I think, eventually, when Truro City get their act together. But I just love it that, you know, Macclesfield and Yeovil, and it's all part of the same thing, all the way down to Eastern Cowboys in the 23rd run. And I think there's something to be said for that. You know, the kind of the experience of breakaway radical sports organisations is poor, you know, because, like, we've been here before. I mean, the workers' sports movement of the interwar era, you know, which was big enough and strong enough to put on three workers' Olympics in the 1930s, ended up, you know, being a bit of a disaster. Similarly, the you know, you had separate red leagues in Vienna in the 1930s. Which lost out because in the end nobody wanted to go and watch, you know, because the other football was just better. I mean, that's my understanding of it. Or, you know, or the Islamic League in Israel. I mean, there's one side of the equation in Israel that says, you know, football's a sphere in which the possibility of equality exists. This is an area in which integration might be possible. So most Arab Israelis, you know, are really, really into their football. You know, I mean, even support, you know, traditionally kind of Zionist Jewish teams like Maccabi Haifa has a big Arab population. And then you've got the Islamicists who just say, you know, fuck it, I'm not playing with you guys. We're having our league, we're only playing ourselves and each other. And, you know, they really do stop five times during a game for prayer. And it's the works, you know, it's very, very, very strictly sort of, you know, a version of Sharia law applied to, you know, 11-a-side amateur football. And I kind of think, you know, there's enough division and separation, and we're all such small fish anyway. I kind of think there are real dangers of going down quite such a radical route. So I suppose, you know, a bit of a fight from within kind of character. Doesn't mean I'm right, but that's sort of my disposition, I think.
Yeah, I was just wanting to bring it back to what you're saying about kind of football crossing boundaries and kind of playing the bad guys, kind of that idea. And that then you also kind of think that football as this great cultural phenomenon has the potential to influence things massively. In a way, I've taken the example, the racism in the
England, Spain, friendly event. That personally, I think at that point the players should have left the pitch, and that could have had a really positive effect in kind of changing attitudes of the fans. But then the kind of counter argument is that it's kind of against the game to do that. It's kind of against the.
But the law is there, though. You know, they have the right to under sort of UEFA regulations. They are entitled to walk off the pitch at that point. I mean, I think there would be a lot to be said for one major symbolic demonstration of that. You know, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, it should be happening all the time and, like, the merest slight should result in everybody walking off the pitch. But I do think, you know, on the issue of racism in European football anyway, there's definitely a place, and I'd have been very proud of the England team if they'd have, you know, had the chutzpah and the leadership to do that. I mean, it's quite a lot to ask, though. You know, these guys, you've got to remember who and what they are. You know, they're not, you know, for all the talk of kind of leadership, I mean, actually, what does John Terry know about leadership? I mean, he knows how to lead a punch-up, is what I surmise. Actually, leadership, courage, vision, putting yourself, actually, because most footballers, my limited knowledge of professional football culture is they're real conformists, incredible conformists, you know, the kind of, are their cultures more insular and more kind of quietly authoritarian than what goes on inside football dressing rooms? You know, so there's a real reluctance. You know, it's very rare that you get someone like, I don't know, like Cruyff, who really would just stand up and say what he thought and fuck the consequences. You know, Rio Ferdinand's lovely, but he's not made of that kind of stuff from what I can. More's the pity. So I think on that occasion or a similar occasion there is a case for it. You know, I think there is a case for it. But I don't think it should be a regular, I don't think, you know, you run the risk of sort of opening the floodgates. But so it's not something to be done lightly.
But at the same time, I was just thinking, as you were saying, it being possibly the biggest global kind of cultural thing, that it just seems amazing that it seems almost a waste that there's so much potential for getting a message across.
You've got to be careful not to load it. I come back to David James and his man going to Portsmouth. It's like, yes, there is a politics with a small p, and partly it's about saying there are spaces and places where politics and power and money shouldn't rule. So it's quite a hard balancing act to sort of, on the one hand, yeah, you do want to make it to make some political statements or send some sort of positive cultural messages to the world. But if you overlay it with too much and it sort of becomes, you know, then you're in the realm of the Spartakiada, you know, or the kind of communist kind of insane sporting display that shows the kind of, you know, the power of the global proletariat. And then everybody falls over and laughs because then it looks completely ridiculous. So it's a really hard balancing act, I think, for everybody involved in football, is to work out, you know, how far you can take it without making yourself look ridiculous, how far you can invest it with really important and significant meanings without at the same time sort of almost destroying them or undermining them. And I think the case you brought up is like, it's a great example of, you know, just kind of where that line is. So, you know, football ain't bringing world peace anytime soon, or global sustainability, or any of that. But, you know, it can make its own distinct and small contributions, partly by preserving a space that says, actually, there's values and things that are more important than money and power.
Well, I've got one minute. It's 10:30 now, so...
Yeah, my babysitting's like getting to the limits.
So if everybody's happy, unless everybody really wants to speak, then
Well, I guess it could be a good way to end. Coming back to Richard's point about, you know, what's the best way to kind of take on this monopolisation of the game. But do you think there's a chance that it might be that monopolisation that brings it down anyway, because it seems to me that it's not sustainable, the Premier League at least, where you've got teams that have got no chance of ever winning anything, investing millions and millions of pounds. We've already seen teams, you know, my team sort of went into administration this season, but bigger teams are starting to really struggle now, you know, teams like Coventry that put too much money in, realise they can't win everything. It seems to me that Leicester. Eventually, yeah, these teams are going to go to the wall. And while that's really sad, you know, the tradition and the, you know, to the fans, it also opens up an opportunity to start again and the fans to kind of look at what's happened and say, you know, well, why did that happen? Shouldn't we be more involved? So it might be that the system itself collapses because the teams can't. It's all based on, you know, no, the clubs aren't sustainable. These millionaires putting in money, it's not based on, you know, a good economic model.
Oh, it's the economics of madness. I mean, Abramovich has pumped up £400 million, you know, to make Chelsea what they are today. And the idea that they're going to be sort of sustainable in 10 years, according to Peter Kenyon, is just beyond laughable. I mean, it's almost everything Peter Kenyon says. I mean, you know, yeah, capitalism has its crises and its contradictions, and I don't think the Premier League is about to break that iron law of social development. I mean, I think it will. It, you know, the paradox is, of course, that you have to remember is that, you know, while people sort of slightly moan and groan and say, oh, look at Bolton, UEFA Cup, 9,000 people, the reality is that the figures are now the highest that they've been. Attendance at football, Premiership, and at every level of professional football. It hasn't been this, like this since the early 1960s, you know, when there was only two TV channels and men still determined what they did on a Saturday, not the misses. And, you know, that's an awful lot of social development that's had to be sort of clawed back to get to the level. So far at one level, it really is working. However, you know, we're only, what, the Premiership is now 15 years. So, you know, we're in the cycles of these things still relatively early. Yeah, it may be all too much. I mean, you know, four teams at the top, endlessly recirculating, teams constantly, you know, economically and practically imperiled by relegation and overambition, and a lot of, you know, people stuck in the middle. I mean, it was hard. Tottenham, you know, neither in top six nor bottom six for 13 years. It was slightly, it kind of like drains you after a bit. Thing. Oh, 11th, that'll be interesting. You almost sort of want to get relegated for the excitement of that. There are moments I have actually thought that. After they fired, what's the name? The French guy before Yol.
Santini.
That's the man. I was on the verge of wishing them to be relegated. So maybe, you know, I mean, in a way I sort of hope so, because out of those sort of crises come, you know, opportunities to do something different. And the possibility, you know, it's going to be moments like, it's only going to be when something like that happens that serious economic reforms to ownership, wage structures and all of that can even begin to be contemplated.
Right, I'd just like to say thanks for everybody for coming, and it's a good day.